Good morning. It's Saturday, August 9th, and you're listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMMLP in Burlington, Vermont. I'm Shayla Shapiro, your host for Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. Write the Book features interviews with authors, poets, illustrators, agents, and editors. Today on Write the Book, you'll hear a conversation with Michael Collier. A professor of English and co-director of the Creative Writing Program at the University of Maryland, Michael Collier is the author of several books of poems, including The Clasp and Other Poems, The Folded Heart, The Ledge, and Dark Wild Realm. He has been director of Middlebury's Breadloaf Writers Conference for 15 years. When I interviewed Michael 2 weeks ago, I first asked if he'd aspired to be a poet from an early age.
I didn't aspire to be a poet from a young age, but I did want to start writing. I knew I wanted to be a writer, and that was something that began to fascinate me when I was in high school, towards the end of my senior year. I had been reading something like a novel a week in a class. It was one of these advanced placement classes. Mm-hmm. And at one point, I just remember thinking, that I would like to be able to put that many words together the way these writers had. And it seemed a really interesting challenge. It also seemed something that I would never be able to do. So as that kind of a challenge, I just began to imagine ways of doing it. So my summer after I graduated from high school, every day I would write a page. I would just sit down and write and try and fill it up. And I wasn't telling story. I wasn't, really working from image. It was just language coming out of me. And it was mainly, as I said, very unformed. The only poetry I really knew when I was in high school were song lyrics. So when I would try and write what I thought was poetry, it came out more like song lyrics, mm-hmm. More like a Bob Dylan, let's say.
Who's a good example of probably the best poet songwriter?
pretty good. You know, better than Led Zeppelin or Grand Funk Railway or somebody like that. Someone like Jimi Hendrix seemed impossible to imitate because it was, of course, the lyrics were there, but the music itself, the melodies, seemed so much more compelling.
Right.
And so then I did start to read poetry when I got into college.
Okay.
And then I started to write both, but I still didn't have a real good sense. I mean, I was reading a lot, but I didn't really know how to study models. I was just moving by instinct and feel, mm-hmm. through everything. And it wasn't until the end of my college days as an undergraduate that I really felt like I knew how to look at a piece of writing, mm-hmm. and take things away as a writer, that I was beginning to actually imitate writers. And that's when the real learning, I think, began. As I continued to write after my undergraduate days, I found that I was drawn more and more to the strangeness and the mystery and the kinds of jumps you could make in poems.
I wonder if this would be a good time for you to read something from Dark Wild Realm.
Well, since we have a lot of bird song,
right.
in the background here, and there are a lot of birds in this book,
yeah,
strangely so.
That was another question I had. That was not intentional, or?
Well, I don't know what intention is, really, to tell you the truth, because that's not how I write. I just found that in writing these poems, birds just kept coming in, they kept getting in the way. And since it's a book really of elegies for a group of friends who died in a rather short period of time, they seem to be like messengers or avatars, I guess. So I'll just read the first poem, which is called Birds Appearing in a Dream.
And I'm just going to interrupt and say this,
yeah.
is Michael Collier reading from Dark Wild Realm.
Birds Appearing in a Dream. One had feathers like a blood-streaked koi. Another a tail of color-coded wires. One was a blackbird stretching orchid wings. Another a flicker with a wounded head. All flew like leaves fluttering to escape bright, circulating and burning air, and all returned when the air cleared. One was a kingfisher trapped in its bower, deep in the ground, miles from water. Everything is real and everything isn't. Some had names and some didn't. Named and nameless shapes of birds, at night my hand can touch your feathers, and then I wipe the vernix from your wings. You who have made bright things from shadows, you who have crossed the distances to roost in me. So that wasn't really the first poem that I wrote for this book, but it seemed to be a good way to start it, because there are a lot of nightscapes and dream atmosphere in the books, mm-hmm. in the collection.
I was really struck in reading these poems by how clearly birds are not just pretty things, you know. And I think that's true in nature, you know. Mm. I mean, they're wild and they are violent sometimes. Mm. And the poems have so much color and description, but there's also a lot of the dark side of that wild world that comes through, which I suppose must be what you were feeling at the time.
They felt like, I don't write at night, I write early in the morning, but they feel like nighttime poems. Mm. And so if that's a kind of literal darkness out of which they come, you know, that might be an accurate way to think of them. Another way to think of them really is it's a book trying to think about, you know, the so-called underworld and the world of shades and death. So I think that that's, you know, where a lot of the emotional darkness comes in.
A lot of references to fire as well, I noticed.
I don't know. I'll have to go back and look. I hadn't noticed that either. But that's why the idea of intention is something I don't quite understand, because the language seems to have its designs on us as writers. Mm-hmm. And so you're constantly learning things about what it is you've put down. Mm-hmm. And so usually what escapes intention is the more interesting things about what you produce. Mm-hmm. And those things that you intend to write about are usually only as good as you've been able to escape your own best intentions.
Do you think that helps to explain why it's so hard to write about the things that are closest to us, the things that matter most?
It could be. I mean, I think that we're, you know, mostly thinking about it that way, I guess you'd have to say that we are our own worst, you know, self-analyzers. And that's why you have to escape your own intentions, if you can. Because usually the way you think about yourself or see yourself, it's the same way about, you know, how you imagine what your voice sounds like. It's one thing, and then when you hear it on tape, it sounds like something completely different. You sound like another person. Mm-hmm. And so it's hard for you to hear what that other person sounds like or to anticipate what that other person sounds like. So the best thing to do is just forget about it. Mm-hmm. Forget about trying to figure out in advance what that person's going to sound like.
What you just said reminded me of something that you wrote in one of your essays that was in Make Us Wave Back. The opening essay, One Utterance: when we write, we want to escape, at least partially, from the received meaning of words. Do you think you could talk about that a little bit?
We don't often understand what it is we're working with, and yet we want to. You know, we want the poems to make a certain kind of meaning. Mm-hmm. And often the meaning that we want a poem to make is self-contained. It's in its own world. That doesn't mean it doesn't have access to the social world. But since it's a work of art, it needs to be self-referential in a kind of complete way. And it's hard to get outside of the language enough to see how that's operating. I guess one of the ways to think about it is that, and this is what makes poetry so powerful as a medium, is that everybody uses language to communicate in either complicated or really simple ways. So we think we own the language. We think we understand the medium. But when you encounter a poem is actually working against, as I say in that little passage, the received ways that we understand language. And so we're constantly caught in these two realms.
Mm-hmm.
The realm of understanding and the realm where the language seems to be confused and energized in a different kind of way.
Mm-hmm. As I read many of these poems in Dark Wild Realm, I had the sense that a story, had inspired or shaped them. Although as the poem goes on, it's not necessarily it's not a prose poem at all, but I had the sense of the story behind each of the poems. Is that true of your work?
Yeah, I would say that there's almost always some kind of incident that has happened that the poem is either reflecting or interrogating. Mm-hmm. There are a few poems in A Dark Wild Realm that feel more purely lyric, and the stories are obfuscated. They're not as easy to make out.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And they run more on language itself, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
What's the revision process like for you?
It's long. I'll work on a poem for years sometimes, and other times maybe not. Maybe it won't be so long, but it's very slow.
Is it? Do you ever have a sense that okay, that's my first draft, or do you feel like you're sort of revising from the get-go?
Oh yeah, no, it's constant revision. Yeah, and it happens at different rates because sometimes in a first draft you'll get more traction. I'll get more traction and feel as if I've got farther along the road to the poem, and then there's others where I'll get 10 lines down and really I don't, the kind of impulse that started the poem has dried up and I really don't know what to do with it, so I bail on it and I just put it in one of my folders. So it depends on kind of how far I've gotten on a first draft, but then what I do is I go back, I have these folders and I go back and I kind of comb through them.
Mm-hmm.
And there'll be a folder where the poems seem to be three quarters of the way finished, and then one where they're halfway finished, another where they're quarter. This is tedious, but anyways, and I'll just keep going through those different folders and pulling things out and working on them a little bit more and then putting them back in.
Do you ever steal from one to
yeah that would be great. I'd love to consolidate. And sometimes one will, that I think I have, some purchase on, will lead me into a dead end. But something else will come out of it.
Mm-hmm.
That'll be finally be the poem.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But I'm a constant reviser.
I wonder if we can talk a little bit about Bread Loaf.
Mm-hmm.
What is your history with Bread Loaf?
Well, my history is that I first attended Bread Loaf in 1981. On a tuition scholarship, and then I came back in 1986 as a fellow after my first book was published, and then in the early 90s I went back, and at the time there was a position called associate staff where you kind of assisted a faculty member, and so I came back in the early 90s a few times as an associate staff.
Mm-hmm.
Person, and then in 1994 I was hired to be the director. And my first term started, my first session was 1995.
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of the outline of my relationship to the conference. But my real relationship is like everybody else's that goes there. And that is, they have a kind of overwhelming experience from being in this community of writers who are passionately engaged with what they're doing, and also just the overwhelmingly beautiful surrounding.
How difficult is it to get into Bread Loaf as an applicant?
Well, it's a lot more difficult than when I started. In 1995, we had about 600 applications.
How many people attend?
200.
200, okay.
Out of that 600, overwhelmingly, most of them would have been people applying for financial aid, particularly work-study, the waiters, that young group. And so the number of people applying as, straight applicants would be much smaller in that group. Now, this year, we had 1,500 applications. And so it's actually, I think we admit 6%. So it is much more difficult than it used to be. Just the sheer numbers make it so. Mm-hmm. So, we're in this really great position of being able to invite, people whose level of sophistication is fairly high. Mm-hmm. That doesn't mean that, there isn't still a lot of work that needs to be done. But it is different than it was when I first started. Mm-hmm. So yeah, we have this wonderful opportunity to invite really terrific people.
And you get some fantastic faculty as well.
Yeah, people like to come to Breadloaf. It's not too hard to convince them.
What's the process for finding faculty members?
There are a couple ways of doing it. One is I try and find out if someone is a good teacher, if they like to teach, if they think that it's an enterprise, if they believe in the enterprise and aren't kind of jaded by it or skeptical about it. And also, people who are mainly open and generous, and that's part of believing in teaching, mm-hmm. Not minding being with students,
right?
Those kinds of things, because the environment's very—it's very intimate and intense, and you don't want the faculty to be wanting to go off all alone, by themselves all the time. Although certainly, they work hard and they do need to be. Have time alone, have a place to go. Because part of the pleasure for the faculty, of course, is coming and seeing their friends.
Each other.
They
must have, their own sort of like little alumni sense.
Yeah, it's the same joy they take in returning to Breadloaf that right. Everybody else takes. So that's what I try to figure out, is if they're good teachers. And the way I do that is, I can talk to people who know them. And just by reputation, you can find that out.
Now, one component of the teaching, one big component, is the workshop.
Right.
So is that part of it, to try to find out what they're like in workshop?
Well, I figure if they're good teachers, if they believe in the enterprise, they're probably pretty good in workshop. But I wouldn't want a dud in there. But I honor different styles of teaching, because I don't think you would want one way of the workshop being taught. So the faculty that come teach, many different ways.
Right. I think that's more where my question was, because I know that there are some people that do not want to be in a workshop that's, kind of cutthroat, and there are some teachers that have more of the sort of, tough love approach, and there are others that are a lot more...
I would say, by and large, the faculty that come to Breadloaf are not faculty who use the workshop to make people feel as if they don't know something. That's a kind of model from the past it's still around, but not so much anymore. Mm-hmm. So those things are important. Yeah. And then, of course, that they're terrific writers,
right.
That they're good writers.
Right.
They're real practitioners.
What's different about the other than the number of applicants that you get? What's different about the conference now than in the past?
Well, I think the past is a long time ago now. it's 15 years, almost.
Your past.
Exactly. Yeah.
Okay.
I think what's happened in the last. Let's say decade, a little more than a decade, is that those things that I've been talking about, those qualities that we've been talking about that faculty members have, of creating a kind of community in the workshop, But at the same time, you know, being rigorous, not letting things slide, creating a community in the workshop that then radiates out into the rest of the conference so that people feel secure and confident when they go to readings, when they go to lectures. They feel recognized, they feel taken seriously and honored, they feel as if they have a place at the conference. Because, you know, as you know from your own experience, there's lots of different levels. There's this group of young writers who are get a lot of attention because they're serving food and, you know, they're performing a little bit. And then there are the fellows who have just published a book or have had a second book published. And then there are tuition scholars. And all these different levels have to kind of, you know, work together and create this community and not create cliques, which is, you know, our natural inclination is to create groups within groups. So one of the things I think we've tried to do at the conference is to make people feel more included. And the other thing too, the thing that's changed dramatically is the diversity at the conference. And it's diversity at all levels. And that's one thing I've been very happy about, that we've been able to make the community at Breadloaf more like the literary community at large in the country.
Talking about diversity just makes me wonder about the age of the attendance as well. Like, what's the median age? Do you know?
I couldn't tell you what the median age is.
It's all over the place, though, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I would have to say maybe 40, maybe 38, somewhere in there. And so we have people, you know, participants in their 80s. Their 70s and their 60s.
What's the name of the gentleman who came every year?
Norton Jarrell.
Norton.
And Norton still comes.
Does he come every
year?
Yeah,
he still comes. He's fantastic.
Yeah.
And Ronnie Klaskin has been coming for almost as many years.
Okay.
So we do, we do have, you know, people who have been coming for years who are now senior or elderly, whatever phrase you want to use. But then we have people who are applying, who are in those age ranges all the time anyway.
Right, sure.
And, you know, they're competing with a younger group, but really it's the writing that we look at, because we don't have letters of recommendation. We just really look at the writing sample.
Mm-hmm. You have an essay in Make Us Wave Back that's actually taken from an introductory talk at Breadloaf, at the 75th anniversary.
Right, yeah.
Right? And you said in that talk that there's the risk of a particular kind of adventure that a writer undertakes in participating in Breadloaf, or in a conference like Breadloaf. The risk of a particular kind of adventure. So what is at risk for a writer who's coming to Breadloaf?
Well, I think there are a couple things that are at risk. Risk is a positive word. One of the risks a participant runs at Breadloaf is being disabused of certain notions. And those could be that they have a book that if they could only show it to the right editor or agent, it would be published immediately. Okay. And so the risk is coming there and thinking that that's what you want to do, not having it done, and then what do you come away with?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And in my experience, if someone comes with that attitude, with that notion that, you know, they have this finished work and it's going to get discovered and everything else is going to change for them, they usually understand. They come to an understanding at some point. They still need more to do more work on the book, and they're not disappointed in that deep, kind of resentful way.
Mm-hmm.
And they don't hold it against Breadloaf. So I think that's one of the risks that.
Right. Well, your first reaction can be very disappointed to realize that your work isn't what you thought it was. But you work in a vacuum when you're a writer, you know? And
right.
And to have that clearer vision after must be a relief in some ways, too.
Yeah, understand. No, I think that that's a good way to put it. The other thing is that the first couple days of the conference are really interesting, the first 2 days in particular, because everybody comes from some other place. and they're leaving a life behind. And they go up to this mountain retreat where you can't use a cell phone unless you're really smart about finding out the one or two places where you can use it. You're isolated. No one cares if you're a lawyer or a doctor or a documentary filmmaker or whatever it is, psychologist or whatever it is you do out in the world. Everybody is a writer. So for the first couple days, you're losing your identity in a way. And what you're doing really is giving yourself up to an institution. Mm. You're giving yourself up to a place that operates in a particular way. Prisons do this, mental hospitals do this, the army does it. You know, it's all a matter. You have to give something of yourself up to the project. And at first, people can have a hard time doing that. Once they do, then I think things usually go well for them.
My last question is back to you as a writer. When you are working on a poem, do you have a certain exercise or activity or habit that you turn to when you're stuck in your work?
The way I hear that is that there's some little trick or key that would make the poem get down on its knees. Or open up or whatever. I don't, but what I do sometimes when I feel like when I'm particularly dead in the head, when I don't have any kind of connection to language, when it doesn't seem interesting, when I feel stale, is I'll read something. There are two ways that I do this. I'll read something that I loved when I first started to write. I'll go back. Mm-hmm. Or I'll read something that is so different from the way that I write that it puts a certain kind of pressure on me to think about language in a different way. So those are two things that I do fairly regularly.
Different in a good way?
Well,
somebody you respect, but who writes?
Somebody that I respect, sure, but just someone who I feel temperamentally the writing is different. Mm-hmm. That it comes from being in the world in a different way, a way that I don't understand or experience exactly. And that sometimes will help me. It just demands that I get outside of myself, get outside of my habits of approaching language. I suppose those are exercises, but I don't have something I do, some way I manipulate language.
Well, thank you very much.
You're welcome. Thank you. Thanks for including me in this conversation.
I hope you enjoyed that interview with Michael Collier. Next week, tune in at the same time to hear the first half of an interview with Vermont mystery writer Archer Mayer. If you're interested in sharing Write the Book with out-of-town friends, let them know they can stream it live every Saturday morning at www.theradiator.org. Archived episodes of Write the Book are also available on iTunes as free podcasts. If you have comments about the show or events for next week's Bookworms calendar, please send an email to writethebook@gmail.com. Stay tuned. Hike Bedrosian is up next. This has been Write the Book. I'm Shayla Shapiro, and you're listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMM LP in Burlington, Vermont.